about last time. So before then, sure, we're going to start off. I just want to do a bit of a recap. What we did at the end last week, we couldn't quite finish in terms of Chalav Akum, and then we'll move on to tonight's topic, which is Tefillat Kelim, which is actually split up into the book into two separate topics. We'll split that up as well. It's obviously very practical at the moment. Well, not so practical at the moment, which is why it's become a practical question, especially before Pesach. And even now, a lot of people are asking, you know, many of the Kelim mikvahs are closed and the rest should be closed. You know, what do we do if we have new pots and pans and dishes, which we can't go in toivel? So we'll discuss that as well. We're doing this unusual situation. So again, I'm going to put on the share screen again. Just to recap briefly, last week. Sorry, just mute everybody. As always. Okay. Last week we started talking about Chalav Akum. So we spoke about the fact that Chazal made a gzeirah on certain types of foods. We spoke about Bishul Akum the week before. We spoke about Pat Akum. We spoke about Chalav Akum, certain things which are manufactured, produced, processed by non-Jews, which we learned we're not going to be allowed to eat. And we saw that in many cases, even where there was no actual concern for the ingredients that are in the food, even if the ingredients are completely kosher, nonetheless, as I added an extra safeguard, that we shouldn't eat these. We saw that by Chalav Akum, the Gemara actually states explicitly that part of the reason is because we're worried that it might be mixed in with non-kosher milk. So there is a concern that there may be non-kosher ingredients there as well. And then we saw what was the quest, we asked, well, what would happen when we're in a situation where the original reason for the decree no longer applied? So over here, where the original decree was, the original reason was that you might have non-kosher milk added in. So there were poskim, notably the pre-chadash, and others who said, well, if the original reason no longer applies, then the gzera wouldn't apply as well. And you could have a situation where you know that they didn't add in anything extra. For example, there are no non-kosher animals within the flock. That it might be allowed. Arguing very vehemently against that were a number of poskim. I'm not sure if we mentioned last week the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer comes out very strongly against the pre-chadash. He says even if the reason no longer applies, the gzara still applies. I want to just share with you in the book. We have a source here from the Aruch HaShulchan who also shares this view, that even if the reason now no longer applies, nonetheless, we still have to be cautious. And he says like this. You should be able to see the Aruch HaShulchan in front of you. He says like this. Uliyat Yaseh, Tavale Elecha, Ech Shekodva, Rabotainu HaKadoshim, Hem Gachalei Esh. Says the words of our sages are like fire. Mashit Vada Lefanai Belev Nishbal, and says, I heard the story as with the trembling heart. Biyoti Yoshev Al Kisela Al Bi'il Plonit, when he was the rabbi in a certain city, this was the case. Shechad Me Ba'alei HaBatim HaChashuvim, Bishamayan Hoheg Heter B'davar. Is that one of the Ba'alei Batim over there, thought that this was allowed. He used to travel somewhere where I guess milk wasn't so easily available, and therefore he would rely on this leniency. Every morning they would drink their hot water. They would buy the certain milk. By this non-Jewish shopkeeper outside where they were staying. And it happened once. They started discussing. This was very fatty milk, very creamy milk. Where did you get it from? And one of them went to ask him, and he said, I go to the meat market, I buy the brains of the animals, and I crush it up together with the milk, umvashlim beyachad, and we cook it together, and that's how it gets so fatty. And then says the Aruch HaShulchan, as naflu kulam apneim achetam agadol she'achlu treifot basav v'chalav. Says everybody was very, very fell on their faces. They were very remorseful about the sin that they'd been eating non-kosher. So he uses that story to prove that, and you could argue again that in that situation they didn't actually know. It's not the same level as government regulations. We'll get to in a moment. But nonetheless, uses that story as well to prove that even where you think maybe the reason no longer applies, sometimes the reason still does apply. I mentioned as well that in one of the reasons the Chatam Sofer says it also, I just saw today an article written about 17 years ago by Rav Bakshi Doron. Rav Bakshi Doron, who was the chief rabbi of Israel, sadly just passed away a few weeks ago from coronavirus. And he wrote an article about the position of the Rabbanut Rashid regarding Chalav Akum. And at the time, and he says, it could be that part of the reason why the Chatam Sofer was so stringent as well is that there are extra reasons aside from the ones which are listed explicitly. We said at the beginning of this whole series that certainly when it comes to Pat, when it comes to Bishul Akum, when it comes to wine, which we'll discuss in a few weeks' time, it was again to prevent intermarriage. And even though that's not listed explicitly regarding milk, it comes into play as well. And this is what the Aruch HaShulchan says over here. Be'emet kach mekublani, here in bold, shukol gzarat chachamim, levat tamam anigle, all the gzarot we have aside from the open reasons that we're told, yesh od harbe tamim kumusim shelo gilu otam. Many times, there are other hidden reasons why these gzarot apply. And therefore, even if we think the reasoning no longer applies, nonetheless, and there may be other reasons as well. All that notwithstanding, in modern times, there's a very big leniency which we find when it comes to Chalav Akum. And the one who really made this famous was Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he says, and over here, it's a much greater level of yidya, of knowledge. What he essentially says is that we saw in the Gemara that if a non-Jew was milking and there was a Jew who was supervising, and that way you knew that there was no non-kosher milk being added in, then it would be permitted. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, nowadays we have something better than just a Jew sitting there supervising. We have the government supervising, right? We have what we call pikuach mimshalti, government supervision. And therefore he says, in such a case, with our regulations, and we know that they aren't mixing in anything non-kosher, that if they do, they would be punished, the whole business would be closed. He says, therefore, one can be lenient when it comes to Chalav Akum. Again, everybody quotes the first part of the tshuva. Again, Rav Moshe talks about this four or five different places. Everybody is very fond of quoting the fact that he says it's allowed. People are less fond of quoting the rest, where he says actually it's allowed if nonetheless, somebody who can be stringent and who wants to be stringent, that is certainly praiseworthy, and that's what he does himself. He says somebody wants to be lenient, can be lenient regarding this. And then just about which is not involved, for somebody who's a bal nefesh, somebody who's trying to take on an extra level of stringency, they can, should be stringent. This is not one of those cases where it's something which is viewed to be haughty, that somebody's taking on an extra stringency. He says, and this is how I myself am stringent. There's another guy of the last generation who it's reported that he himself was lenient, and that's Rav Soloveitchik. We have later on in the book, there's a quote here in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Jachta. Says, well known among Rav Soloveitchik's students, Rav drank packaged milk that did not have special rabbinic supervision. Rav Aganak mentioned in a share at Yeshiva University that the Rav told him there exist three conditions to be lenient. Number one, if there are no non-kosher animals found in the herd of animals being milked, many rule leniently. Second, we rely on government supervision. And number three, technically the rabbinic edict forbidding drinking milk doesn't apply today since the cows are milked by machines. So all those factors together, he was lenient on it. As we said last week, there are many kashrut agencies in Chutz Laaretz that are more lenient. The regulation of the Rabbanut HaRashit in Israel, that the Rabbanut HaRashit will not give authorization for actual milk, which is Chalav Akum. And again, the reason for the distinction is simple, that in Israel, Chalav Yisrael is much more easily and much more readily available, and it wouldn't cause any sort of difficulties. Rav Moshe's Heter as well was in a situation where there's a difficulty and where it may not be so easy to acquire Chalav Yisrael. Moving on, it's in terms of actual milk. But what about all other types of derivatives, things we get from milk? Somebody mentioned butter last week, and the discussion about cheese. But before that, we get what's called avkat chalav, which is milk powder. And this is in the modern food industry, and it's very, very common. There are all different types of proteins, types of powders of ingredients, enzymes, which are derived from milk. not mukta himself, would the same halachot apply to avkat chalavakum, to milk powder, which is an ingredient in all sorts of puddings and chocolates and all sorts of things, as it would for milk itself. So the Chazon Ish, okay, again, before we get into whether it's permitted or not, first of all, he says you should know that there is no difference between milk and milk powder. We know that when it comes to cheese or when it comes to butter, they have their own separate halachot, possibly, to milk itself. The reason for that is that they're a different substance. The way that it's manufactured, if it comes from a non-kosher animal, non-kosher milk, the Gemara tells us there's a difference between kosher and non-kosher milk. Non-kosher milk will not form butter, will not form cheese. And therefore, there's more room to be lenient, possibly, by those things, at least for that reason. But he says when it comes to milk powder, there's no difference. You see here the Chazon Ish, source number 39, he says, Avkat chalav, eino inyan legvina v'chema, it's nothing to do, not similar in any way to cheese and butter. The gvina nasa lidei afrashat amayim in agush, v'afrasha zo nasa lidei chimut shenotnim b'chalav. Okay, there's a whole sort of process, physical process, which is made to separate things from the milk, which can be done with kosher milk, but not with non-kosher milk. I'm going to skip about halfway through over here, where he says, aval avkat chalav, what is milk powder? Milk powder is very simply, where you take, he says, avil cham v'yavesh, you take hot, dry air, v'lachut shel chalav kala ba'avir, and the moisture is sort of evaporated, and you're left with milk powder, essentially, you know, freeze-dried milk, however it's done today, but it can be done with any milk. It's irrelevant whether it's slaughtered off as a kosher animal or non-kosher animal. And therefore, he says, in terms of the physical substance, we wouldn't distinguish between milk and milk powder. Nonetheless, very famous heter of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, writing in the 1940s, he says that whereas physically we may have thought it's the same thing, but halachically, he says that there would be a difference. And he says also, he based it on discussion about butter. As I said last week, somebody mentioned butter. There's a machloket regarding chemat akum, butter, which comes from a non-Jew, whether that would be allowed or not. There are those, it's a machlok going back all the way to the Gaonim, and there are those that are stringent, there are those that are lenient. But we see that there is room within Chazal to allow it, even though they prohibited milk, maybe didn't prohibit butter. And therefore, he says there are different substances, we look at them differently. And therefore, the original Gezerah was only regarding milk itself, was not regarding any other milk derivatives, other milk products. And therefore, in Shutar Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says, he says, "Aval avkat chalav zo lo hayta b'chalal la'gzera she'arei lo gvinai." He says, "This is not at least regarding cheese. It's not within that gzera." He says, "Powdered milk is not within the original gzera of chalav, and therefore he allows it." Now, again, context is important here. We're talking about in a situation where there was no other milk powder that would be available. Situation of poverty, situations of great need, etc. All these things do play a part. But Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says that avkat chalav akum is allowed, even for those that are stringent on actual milk. That's the important part. If we go according to Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik, who would allow milk itself chalav akum, so certainly milk powder would be allowed as well. There's no difference there. But even according to the stringent opinions that say that milk, which is milk by non-Jew, would not be allowed. Milk powder may be allowed. That's what Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says. Not everybody agrees with this. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was very stringent regarding powdered milk. He said at the end of the day, and as we saw before in the Chazon Ish, at the end of the day, it's the same thing. It's thought of as milk, and there hasn't been any real inherent change going on. And we're talking about the substance, the same substance which was prohibited, it remains prohibited. And so that remains a machloket. And as we said, what's interesting is that when we go back to Israel, again, the Rabbanot HaRashid will not allow something, actual milk, which is chalav akum, but avkat chalav akum, they will allow. Again, part of the reason for that is because that there are more halachic opinions which allow it, also because it's these products, which are processed, etc., in terms of getting chalav Yisrael, avkat chalav Yisrael, is not as readily available. Rav Akshay Doran does write in that article, which is going back 17 years, but he says really the aim of the Rabbanut is moving forward to get to a stage where they would not allow avkat chalav akum. In the ordinary lines, they would allow it. In the Mahadran lines, they won't allow it. And the truth is, over the last few years, many of the factories in Israel as well have switched completely to Chalav Yisrael, lots of the elite chocolates and things like that. You know, if you walk to a supermarket, even if you walk in this country, you'll see that most of those chocolate bars are completely Chalav Yisrael as well. So that's good news for those that want to take on the stringency. But again, as I said last week, we've seen that there's room, there is room for those that are stringent. There is room for those that are lenient as well. All right, let's move on, I think, now to Tvilat Kelim, which is our new topic. Let's give a few pages here on the book, but we'll get there in a moment. Okay, for those that have the book, there are two shirim on Tvilat Kelim, one and two. Tonight we're looking at one. So what we're going to talk about tonight in terms of Tvilat Kelim is, first of all, the obligation of Tvilat Kelim, where it comes from and where, when it would apply, whether it is Doraita or Drabanan. And as we've said in other contexts, knowing whether a mitzvah is Doraita or Drabanan is going to be very significant when it comes to cases of doubt, when it comes to other mitigating factors. We've already alluded to at the moment when it comes to Tvilat Kelim, there are many mitigating factors, and knowing whether something is Doraita or Drabanan may have may make a very big difference. And then we're going to talk about the question of which Kelim require Tvilah on three levels. Number one, in terms of who owns the utensil. Number two, in terms of what the utensil is made of, that's going to be a difference. And number three, in terms of what the utensil is used for. The requirement's only going to be Klei Seudah. We'll talk about exactly what that is. Again, there is quite a lot of gray area in terms of this, partially because the types of utensils and the materials and things that we have today are very, very different from what existed in the days of Chazal and the days of the Rishonim as well. All sorts of new things, new materials, new kelim. So we're going to have to work through those. We'll find that quite often there is a doubt, and quite often we're told you should toivel without a bracha. But we'll get there. So first of all, what is the source of Tvilat Kelim? Where does it come from? The source is in the Chumash, in the Pasuk, that's just after the war against Midian. The Torah tells us that after Bnei Israel won the war against Midian, they also took the spoils of war, and they got many utensils, you know, pots and pans and cooking things. We've discussed this in the past when we learned about Hasharat Kelim, Hagalat Kelim, because of how we kasha non-kosher utensils, because now Bnei Israel got these pots from the Midianim, who obviously did not keep kosher. They had to kasha them as well. So the Torah tells us, Kol davar she'evo ba'esh tavil ba'esh, anything which goes into fire, you will have to put in fire, as we discussed just before Pesach, Hagalah, Nibun, and how all those things work. And then it says, V'taher, and it will be pure, for lack of a better translation. Ach b'mei nida yitchata. But it has to go in the waters of Nida. What are the waters of Nida? That's referring to a mikveh. It has to go in these waters. I see over here they've translated yitchata as sterilized. Again, this is not to do with cleanliness or hygiene, but this has got to do with something spiritual. And that's, at least in terms of kashering, that's the rest of the pasuk, telling us things which are not used in fire, not used for heart, can just be rinsed off, and that would be enough. What concerns us tonight is not how we kasher the utensils, but the question about how we make them tahor, so to speak, how we, the requirement for tefillah. And Rashi explains, depends on the pasuk, what this means. He says, we have two types of tefillat kelim. And it's going to be a big enough communion between them in terms of what you're allowed to do on Shabbat or not. But, Rashi says, when we talk about putting these kelim in a mikveh, first of all, we're talking about tumat met. That, just when we had, all those of tumah and tahara, certainly, you know, the people who had used these pots, these are coming from the spoils of war. Therefore, there would be tumat met, that's the tumah that comes after having touched a dead body. And therefore, they would need tefillah in the mikveh. That is that type of tefillah. Tumah and tahara is not something that we are mapping today. And therefore, that's not something that's relevant nowadays. But he says, nonetheless, so that says Rashi is the simple meaning of the pasuk. However, Rabotenu darshu mikan, but we learn that from here further on, she'af lehachshilan min ha'isul. That's interesting language. Again, we're not talking about making it kosher. The isur, yeah, is not the fact that it's using non-kosher food, but it's hitin tefillah leklima techot, that they need to undergo tefillah and mikvah. The Gemara discusses. We'll get back to Gemara in a second. The Yerushalmi in Masechet Avodah Zarah tells us. Why is it that we have to have this tefillat kelim? Once they go from being owned by a non-Jew and they enter the kedushat Yisrael, they enter the ownership of Am Yisrael. That is when that we require this tefillah. And the Mishnah and the Gemara as well, and the Bavli spells it out for us. Here's the Mishnah which we've learned previously again in terms of kashering. Halokach kli tashmish minagoy. You take a utensil which you acquire from a non-Jew. Those things which go in water. Again, at this point, the Mishnah seemingly talking about just rinsing them off in terms of kashering. Again, la ben bo, and then says the Gemara, Tana. Aside from the fact that you need to kasher them if they've been used for non-kosher food. Again, and this is the point: if you buy something which is brand new, it's never been used for anything. This has not got to do with kashering. This has got to do with the fact that it was owned by a non-Jew, it's now owned by a Jew, and therefore it needs to be, you need to put in the mikvah of Abim Se'ah. Where do we learn this from? And it quotes the Pasuk, Kodaval Asher Yavo Ba'esh, Tavil Ba'esh, V'taher. And we learn it from that extra word, V'taher, telling us that there's this additional hara, which is this Tevilah Mikvah. So is this mitzvah, if we call it that, of Tevilah Kerim, is it Doraita or Drabanan? Is that we're from a Torah level or a rabbinic level? So you'll tell me, well, we've just spent the last 10 minutes or however long it is learning it out from the Psukim. So obviously it should be a Doraita. And that is certainly one opinion. The Trumata Deshen discusses this with an interesting question that he was asked. We may have mentioned before, the Trumata Deshen, according to many opinions, think that he wrote his own questions. These were not questions that maybe he received them as well, but oftentimes he wrote his own questions. It was a book that he composed. And so we know that whenever there's a question, there's a point that he wants to get across. He did it for a question. So it's not something insignificant that somebody maybe asked him, the thing that he really wants to state. And the question, which he says, "Klei matachot alakoach min hanochri." So when you acquire metal utensils, again, we'll talk soon why we say specifically metal, "Shetzarich tvila, shali l'shalcho al-yedei katan l'tvila olav." So can you send them with a child, you know, under the age of Bar Bat Mitzvah, can you send them to go and take them to the mikvah? So his answer is, he says, from addition, you can't do this. Why? Right? There's a whole sugya, which we're not going to get into now, it's discussed, the Gemara discussed in the context of Bikat Chametz and other things, whether something which you need on a Torah level, you need to, know that it's been done properly. Can we trust a child, a minor? Can we believe him regarding this? And he says, no, we can't, because Tevilat Kelim is Doraita. He said, that's the opinion of Truma Tradition. There are other opinions that hold that it's actually Drabanan. That's the Rambam. He writes that Tevilat Kelim actually comes from Divrei Sofrim. He says, Remezla. Right? And when you ask, what about the Pasuk? So again, the Pasuk was sort of a hint, sort of an asmacht, an illusion, which the Rabbis based it on, but not necessarily the source of it. So we seemingly have a machloket as to whether Berkin is Doraita or Drabanan, and it's the majority of Poskim rule that it is a Doraita requirement. Taz says this as well. You see, Avian Sos number 8, this is Lefisha Tvilat Kelim, Doraita. Now again, when we say this is Doraita, this is only regarding metal. This is what Rav Avadia points out. Yom Tov number 9. Mi tevilat kli zchuchit lekulei ama ve'rak midrabanan ubesfeka yesh la'akel. When we, according to everybody, the Torah was discussing metal utensils, any type of metal, and therefore that would be on a Torah level. He says glass would be drabanan. And therefore, again, there would be enough kamina regarding when we have a doubt, not whether we have to do it or not, but whether we may have to make a bracha. Just before we get on now to the conditions as to which kelim, as to regarding who owns it and what it's used for, whether it needs tefillah or not, another important point, and the Rama writes this explicitly, sometimes people are confused, when we spoke about kashering utensils, so we know that if you have a utensil which is not kosher and you cooked food in it, so you have a question about the food, can the food be consumed or not? When it comes to a kli which was not toivot, So the food itself would not absorb any prohibition, so to speak. Source number 10, the Rama tells us, if you use the utensil without tvila, you're not allowed to do it. It's a transgression to do so. However, the food which was cooked inside does not become prohibited. The Biur Halacha says that as well over here in source number 11. This is not to say that you are allowed to use a kli that hasn't gone tefila. We'll talk about that a bit in the next year. You know, what do you do if you go somewhere where it's not your utensils, somebody else's utensils, and you know they haven't undergone tefillah? How do you eat there? Can you eat there? That's a separate discussion. But the actual food itself, you know, assuming that the pot wasn't, the pot hadn't undergone tefillah, it's now served to you on a plate, which has, but, you know that it was cooked in a place where there was no tefillah. You don't have to worry in such a situation, but however, the food is absolutely fine. Okay, so the first thing, in terms of which kelim, require tefillah. Now it's important to understand these requirements as well, because when we get to the question of, you know, nowadays in this unique circumstance where a person may not have the ability to take a kli to the mikveh and to toilet, so if we understand when tefillah is not required, we may understand what the solutions can be. Again, the solutions we'll talk about next time. But first of all, just to understand the basis. So the idea, we saw tefillah kelim is required when it goes from the ownership of a non-Jew to a Jew. And that's the first point, that tefillah kelim is required on kelim which are owned by a Jew. Source number 12, the Gemara Avodah Zarah. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Baravua. Lo shanu ela belekuchin. We are only talking about kelim which were acquired, i.e. they were bought, they were given as a present, they were, in our case, spoils of war. This is kamaseh shaya. Maseh shaya means the case which happened in the psukim, in the chumash. Where they were acquired in war, and therefore they became the property of the Jewish people. Aval she'ulin lo. However, kli which is borrowed, there's going to be very, very significant, many implications of this. If it belongs to a non-Jew, it's just borrowed by a Jew to be used, then it would not require tefillah. We see here the Rashba takes a little bit further. He says, not only if you borrow it, even if you rent it out. If you were to borrow new utensils from a non-Jew, or you were to rent them out, you can use them immediately in ansach in tefillah. They do not require tefillah. Last line in bold, sheila v'schilut enam kunim, because borrowing and renting are not modes of acquisition. Even though you might be using them, strictly speaking, legally speaking, they are not yours. And that's what the Shulchan Aruch says as well. Therefore, you would not require tefillah. However, if a Jew bought it from a non-Jew, and then you lent it to your friend, right? So you now say, I borrow a pot from somebody, and you might think, well, I'm just borrowing it. I don't own it, therefore it doesn't need tefillah. No, that's not correct. If the owner is Jewish, then it would still require tefillah. There's an interesting question that comes up, and this is a more modern question, but in terms of who is the owner, right? The classical case is what was happening in the Gemara, was where, you know, there was a non-Jewish, manufacturer, artisan, craftsman, whatever it is, and the Jew went and bought the pot from him. But, what happens now when things are industrialized? You have a factory. It's not actually owned by any one individual. But it's owned by the factory. It's owned by the company. Who's considered legally the owner? Halachically, who's considered the owner, and would the kli then require tefillah when a Jew buys? So the Aruch HaShulchan discusses, again, the Aruch HaShulchan is, we're going back a little bit over 100 years. So he said, what happens when you have a Jew owning a factory but non-Jewish workers, or vice versa? How do we determine who is the owner of the kelim? He says, let's just see the bit which is in bold. He brings different opinions, but he says, basically, kumo bet chaloshet, like a factory, shosin kelim lemaot v'alafim, where these utensils are being mass produced, hundreds and thousands. Hakol alecha achar bala esek. Everything goes according to the owner of the business. Now, shmoni kelim, v'apolim enem etzlo ela kumo sechirim. It doesn't matter that all the workers, all the laborers are maybe non-Jewish. We go according to the owner. Lachen, if I'm machziku Yisrael, if it's a Jewish owner of the factory, tolim mitzvila af klei metachot, even metal utensils, which would be daraita, would be exempt because they were, from the beginning, they were owned by a Jew, so to speak. Even if the employees are not Jewish. Ulefech, im machziku goy v'apolim Yisraelim, even if all the workers are Jewish, but the owner is non-Jewish, so nafklip tzchuchit, even then glass, which is derabanan, would still need, and tefillah would still require a bracha as well. One important caveat to this is that if there's a partnership, if the factory has joint ownership, more than one, and this may be the case many times today, if it's owned jointly by a Jew and a non-Jew, then it's considered as if it came from, as if it was purchased from non-Jewish ownership, and it would still require tefillah together with a bracha. What happens if you don't know who the owner of the company is? Most of us, go into the shop, go into IKEA, you buy your parts or whatever it is. You don't go and start investigating who the owner is. Maybe IKEA is a bad example. But, Kut Yosef, it's also number 17. He says, we go by the majority. So the case he's talking about, he says, where if you're in a place where the majority of companies are owned by Jews, again, in the majority of places in the world, this probably wouldn't be true. But maybe if it's in Israel, maybe it's which, sound they're made in Israel. Again, a person has to be aware. Even in Israel, you buy many things. You might buy, even Judaica, Kiddush cups. And if you look very carefully, it's made in Taiwan or whatever it is. But if it's something which was produced in a place where most of the factories are owned by Jews, then you would, even without specific knowledge of this one, you would not require tefillah. And you can rely on the fact that it's owned by a Jew. Yeah. One final point on this is as follows. Even if, the Kli had undergone tefillah, but you then sold it to a non-Jew, when you buy, or it was a Jew in the first place, was then sold to a non-Jew, when the Jew buys it back, it's sort of, resets and would require tefillah again. And where this is discussed, this is an explicit Shulchan Aruch. It says, Yisar shemachak li legoy, a Jew sold the utensil to a non-Jew, v'chazav v'lachom imenon, and he went back and he reacquired it from him. Tarech tefillah, it would then need tefillah again. Again, not if you lent it out, not if you rented it out, but you had sold it. And now it becomes yours again. So where this comes up and when people ask the question regarding mechirat chametz, right, on before Pesach. So if you were to sell your pots, your chametz, pots and pans together with your chametz, belong to a non-Jew, and when you bought them back, they would require to be like, again. Yeah.
Cheers, all the best. See you.
Sorry, was there a question? Okay. So by Pesach, many people ask, would you need to do tefillah on your pots and pans? Do you need to sell your pots and pans in the first place? I think we spoke about this in one of the previous shiurim. According to the majority of poskim, you shouldn't sell your pots and pans. There's no actual halacha requirement for it. Going back, there was a time when some of the pots and pans were sold, and that's at a time when you have a kazait of chametz. We're not talking about absorbed flavor. We're talking about actual chametz, dough, whatever it is. Nowadays, our kelim are much, much cleaner than they have been in the past. Actually, very interesting, Rav Melamed of Pnei Halacha, as I say, from Kashrut, which came out not so long ago, a number of months ago, has a very interesting theory that he says that soap, detergent, was only invented around about somewhere in the last 200 years. And he says that's why we see the difference when it comes to absorbed flavor and all sorts of things in our pots and pans, something which did not exist for most of history. He says it's not that the pots change, not that the food change. It's the fact that nowadays we have, sounds trivial, but we have soap, which they didn't always have. And therefore you had lots of bits and pieces of food and crumbs and more than crumbs, bits of dough, which were stuck to the pot. So if you have a kazait of dough, which is stuck to the pot, that would be in a sort of by your ale, by your matzah. And there may be room to say you need to sell the pot. However, nowadays, if you have pots and pans, which have more than a kazait of chametz stuck to them, so I think your number one problem is not going to be what you do with them halachically. and therefore one should not sell the pots and pans. Some say, should you sell the, you know, you sometimes do find shtarei mechira. They talk about selling the chametz, which is absorbed inside the pots and pans. Again, there is no halachic requirement to do that. On Pesach, you sort of buy your ayah or buy your matzeh, something which can be seen or something which can be found. The poskim write very clearly that absorbed taste inside a pot. You know, if you hadn't learned Shulchan Aruch, you'd never, or the Gemara, you wouldn't know that it exists. And therefore, it's not something which we have to be worried about, not something which we have to sell. And therefore, as long as it's done properly, a person shouldn't sell the utensils, shouldn't sell the chametz inside the utensils, and they wouldn't require tefillah when they buy them back after Pesach. I'll just mention now, and we can get into more detail next week, but now that we're talking about it, one of the leniencies in our current situation, and many people relied on this before Pesach, many people are relying on it now, when you have a new utensil and you're unable to take it to the mikveh, so as we've seen, if it belongs to a non-Jew, and it's just borrowed, then there is no requirement of tefillah. And therefore, in our situation, it may be preferable to actually sell the kelim to the non-Jew, again, with the stipulation that you are borrowing them on a long-term basis, that you have permission to use them, but legally, halachically, they're not yours. They belong to whoever purchased these kelim, and this is currently being done, if anybody needs the link, I can send it afterwards. But every day or every few days in Israel, in this country, there are batei din that are arranging for sale, not of chametz, but of utensils. And in this way, people are able to, people are able to use the utensils which they've just bought, without being able to take them to the mikveh, because as we said, the mikvehs are closed. All of us in Britain, this is a leniency for shat adchak. This is not something which people should be relying on in the long term. And, you know, when this passes, and the mikvahs are reopened, and those kelim should still be taken and be toivel. But in the interim, that is one of the etzot which was given. There are others, which we'll maybe talk about next week. Okay, so that's in terms of who owns it. Very briefly, let's just talk about materials, and let's talk about purpose as well. So in terms of materials, we've already mentioned a number of times that it's only metal, it's all types of metal, which require tefillah from the Torah, midrabanan, glass as well. And again, even if it's the rabbanan, we still say a bracha. The case that we wouldn't say a bracha is we're not sure if it actually requires tefillah or not. And one of the cases comes up in the Gemara, and it's a bit of a machlok in the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. But what if we have a material which does not require tefillah? We've said metal does require midoraita. Glass requires midrabanan. Anything else would not require it at all. So things like clay, earthenware, what's called clay cheres, does not require. However, the poskim talk about what's still common today is when you have clay cheres, some sort of earthenware vessel which has a coating, has a covering, which is somewhat glass or metal, something like that, would it still require? The Shulchan Aruch and the Rama have a bit of a disagreement over here. Shulchan Aruch tells Zakunem Agoy Kli Seuda Shal Matechot Shal Zchuchit. So you have something which is metal or glass, or Kelim Ametzupim Be'Eval Mibifnim. So it's a different material which does not require tefillah, but it is coated on the inside with lead. It doesn't have to be lead. Again, it can be any type of metal or glass. Then it would require tefillah. As I said, there's a difference of opinion whether it's just if it requires just coated on the inside or just coated on the outside. The Shulchan Aruch says that only if it's coated on the inside, where it comes into contact with the food, then it would require tefillah. According to the Rama, whether it's coated on the inside or the outside alone, would require tefillah. However, it would be done without a bracha. So if it's lined just on the inside, the Shulchan Aruch is more stringent, and then he says that you need to say a bracha. If it's coated just on the outside, Shulchan Aruch is lenient, so the Rama would be more stringent, and then he says that you need to do tefillah in the first place, but no bracha. What about other kinds of materials? Something which comes up quite a common question. What about plastic? Plastic is a new material, does not exist in the days of the Gemara, and that's the Rishonim. There are also questions regarding kashering. The consensus of most poskim is that plastic is not By the way, we see here on the Rambam as well. He says wood or stone utensils, which they did have, those don't require tefillah. When it comes to plastic, most poskim will say that it does not require. There are some that are machmer, but the vast majority and the consensus is that plastic does not require at all. Certainly when it comes to disposable utensils, you know, things which are only used for one, only intended for one use, you know, you think of aluminium foil. So if it's plastic or paper, so then certainly it doesn't need. What about aluminium foil trays and things like that, which are metal, and metal we've seen does require. Nonetheless, so Moshe Feinstein writes that because it's only intended for to be used once and then thrown away, it does not require tefillah. And the truth is, even if you're going to use it more than once, it would still not require tefillah. Again, there's a minority opinion that would require more, but that's more or less the consensus. You can see on your screens over here a summary of Sefer HaKashrut in terms of what materials would and wouldn't, what would and wouldn't require tefillah, and certain in between cases where we're not sure, we would say that you need without a bracha. So things like porcelain, glazed pottery, things like that. The general minhag would be to do tefillah with that. But as you said, earthenware, pottery, ceramic, unglazed, stone, wood, paper, plastic, all those things, no tefillah required. That's in terms of the material, more or less. The final thing I want to talk about tonight is the function of the kli. And as we've said, it's only when we're dealing with kli se'uda, which means those utensils which are used for preparation or eating of the food. That comes out very clearly from the Gemara, Sechel Avodah Zarah, and tells a story over here, and the Gemara asks, what about if you have things like the example of here, the Zuzah de Salbala, which is a sort of a scissors, which is used for cutting cloth, and we're told, no, that does not require, it's only things which are required in the preparation, the eating of the food. And how exactly we define this is also a little bit of a gray area. It's not completely clear. Certain things, there are certain things definitely which you use to eat, which you use to cook, where the food is placed directly on, you know, when it's edible, or when it's the direct cooking process, that would certainly require tefillah. Things which are very, very far removed, you know, something like a scissors, which you might use to open, you know, to cut open the packets of the food, but is in no way involved in the preparation of the food itself, would not require. But then we get a bit of a gray area. You know, what about something in between? What about something which is used for storage? You know, you have a Tupperware container in which you keep sugar or coffee or tea or things like that. Not really directly, not direct food preparation, but nonetheless it is, you know, coming in direct contact with the food. What about something which is involved in the early stages of food preparation, but it only touches the food when it's inedible. Would that require? So these are things which the poskim discuss. Regarding storage containers, let's just see, well, before we get there, so the example the Shulchan Aruch gives us, he says tripods, right? Tripodish, the tripods, just of thin alem kdelot, I guess these sort of trivets on which you place the pots, right? Enam tonat tefillah, these would not require immersion. These are very, very far removed. They don't come into any contact with the food. However, padeliash, right? Everybody has a padeliash at home. These are grills on which the food is placed. So those, even though it's only, these would require tefillah, and because you put the actual food itself on it. So the trivet underneath which you only place the pot on when it's hot, that does not require. But the grill where the food itself goes does require tefillah, and you know, oven racks or trays where you put the food directly on would probably fall into this category. Bri Chadash points out an interesting point. He says even though these trivets, sometimes you might put the food directly on them, nonetheless, since the primary usage is not to come to contact with the food, then that would be okay. And we've seen this idea of primary usage as well overlap somewhat with when it comes to kashering. The Sefer Tefillat Kelim is a contemporary work as well, written by Rav Tzvi Cohen. There are two volumes, one on Tefillat Kelim and one on Hagalat Kelim. It really goes through all the different examples and all the ideas. He talks about what about these storage containers. So this is somewhat of a gray area because on the one hand, they're not involved in the food preparation. On the other hand, the food really and it's the primary purpose that it comes into contact with the food, which is edible. So he says to do tefillah without a bracha, somewhat of a doubt, and therefore he says you should do tefillah without a bracha. Last example I want to talk about, as I mentioned, what about something which only comes into contact with inedible food? The example the Shulchan Aruch brings is a shechita knife. Certainly, it is used for comes contact with the food, but it's not in the actual cooking. You know, it's earlier. So he says, "Sakin shel shechita yesh mi shomer sheinot tzarich tefillah." There are those who say it does not require immersion. That's a Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah says, "Yesh chokin betov lo tovlo belo bracha." And he says there are those who argue, and therefore we should again do tefillah here without a bracha. And that's the ruling for Ashkenazim. One final point, and on this way end, what about something which is used in the cooking of the food but doesn't come into direct contact with the food itself? So here we have Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the Shutim Nechat Shlomo. He says, if it's, you know, there is a substantial separation, then it would not require tefillah. The example he gives, he says, Kad shemachzikim bo chalav b'sakit. So you have a milk jug, but the it's only there to hold, you know, when you have a, nowadays I guess we usually have bottles, but if you have these plastic bags of milk, and then you have a jug where just for convenience, you know, you would put the bag inside the jug, and you'd pour from there, but the jug itself never really comes into contact with the milk, and he says that would not require tefillah. But there is a substantial separation. However, he says, Im haderech lishtamesh rak al yedei plisat mapa. Because if there really is, it's just, you know, a piece of paper or a piece of foil or something like that, but you're really using it. So we go back to oven trays, you know, you just have a sort of a baking paper which is lining it, but that's where the food goes. And again, that's the primary usage. He says, in such a case, ta'un tefillah in bracha. That would still require tefillah and with a bracha. Okay, we'll leave it there for tonight. Next time. Sorry, yeah, is there a question? No, okay.